Magic Without Fears, Hermetic Podcast. I'm your host, Frater RC. For more and exclusive episodes, visit magicwithoutfears.com. Thank you for your support.
Happy Halloween, everybody. It's Frater RC here, and Marcus Mattern going to do a little chat and hang out for Halloween, for Samhain. And that's what we're doing here. So welcome. We thought we'd start with something fun, and Marcus wanted to discuss the role of occult in cinema and the way in particular that it impacts new practitioners. So that should be very interesting, and I'm excited to see where this conversation goes. Then we're going to talk about a few other things and some announcements at the end, some excitement, and talk about plans for the new year and season, the winter season. So welcome. Welcome. We'll do this for about 45 minutes to an hour or so. See how it goes. And there's a chat. You guys can all chat and make comments, which is always wonderful. Hey, Brent, good to see you, man. Happy Halloween indeed. Thanks for joining us here on the tubes.
Yes. So Frater RC and I have been having amazing chats about everything magic related for well over a year now. And we want to share that with you guys. We want you in on these amazing conversations because it's awesome. And because more people need to be talking about this stuff. Yeah, I want to kick it off talking about the role of the occult in cinema and in TV shows and how that relates to how magic gets experienced in real life and how that creates misconceptions like people thinking the Abermalian is about having water poured over your head and other misconceptions that get spread around. But yeah, I think there can be some useful things that people pick up from cinema, like the fact that magic can be real, can get results. But oftentimes the way that it's depicted in movies is suited to the movie. And so you have physical objects flying around and physical beings manifesting. And that doesn't happen. For the most part, we see etheric beings manifest, and that is not quite the same. And we see energies that will not show up on camera because they are detected with the subtle senses. and so people thinking that magic will be showier than it actually is probably the first misconception. And then just learning to move through develop the psychic senses and the perceptions enough to actually sense what you're doing when you're practicing magic is a whole hurdle to people. And then sometimes it can take people multiple times. I've done so many magic guided rituals, and especially with new people, a lot of people that jump in sensitive and they're blown away by the first experience. And then other people in the same space will be like, I barely felt anything. And it's so dependent on your own development of your subtle senses and how much you're able to sense energy. And so I think the fact that movies are visual media and then magic is primarily not a visual media, it's primarily a media of the subtle senses, is probably the first misconception. What do you think, Frater RC?
In the Arbitel, it really emphasizes in the work with the spirit that it will either be visible or invisible. And I think that's interesting because of the predestination aspect of Calvinist theology in the Arbitel, or you could call it the return of the Greek fatum, the pagan idea of fate. But that's a whole different discussion. What's the difference between Calvinist predestination and the pagan idea of fate? That would be a fun thing to read about, I bet. It's probably been studied. But so are you predestined to see the spirit or not? Is some people just not meant to see them with their physical eyes, and some people are? That's something that it made me think that, and it's interesting when you read the grimoires and you get new ideas from their old guidelines. So I don't know if that really answers your question at all, but
this is a great point actually, which is not everybody can handle it. You'd be amazed at the number of people who start actually seeing spirits either very vividly through clairvoyance or even physically in front of them, particularly angels, since I teach angel magic, and they freak out. And we've been invoking angels for months. What did you think was going to happen? And so it can be disarming for people to understand just how real and just how vivid magic can be once you start to get good at it. And so to a certain extent, I think there is a layer of protection there where it's not necessarily predestination, but it's like their mind defending itself against things that they're not quite ready to experience. And a lot of people love the pageantry of magic and love the showiness. And then when they realize that this is real and it has real consequences and things will actually change, it becomes a whole different deal. A lot of people mess around with the occult because they think some part of them thinks it's not real and therefore it's safe. And whatever this stuff is, it is definitely not safe. So I think it is very much a very important to start to get into this stuff with forbearance, possibly with the teacher, so that you're doing all these rituals the right way, so that you're doing it safely, and so that when you have these experiences, you're actually ready to. And I have seen angels physically manifest. It is a trip. I did not immediately realize that they were angels. I just knew that they were spirits. And I immediately said, I hope you guys are mean, because otherwise I'm screwed. And fortunately, they did. It was good. But yeah, that's something that not everybody experiences. It does take a lot of work, a lot of daily magic to work up to that point for most people. Some people are lucky. They just have amazing, vivid senses straight away. But for most of us, it's a journey. So it's not something that you can expect to experience right out the gate. And that lack of initial wow factor may set people off. But if you have the perseverance to continue, man, there's so much that you can experience and do with magic. I think that's a worthy goal to attain to, even if it's not something that you get straight away. That's an important part of teaching magic, is setting expectations. This isn't going to all happen at once. It's not all going to happen through one ritual. It's not like pressing a button and everything changes. It's not technology. It's more like a workout program where you work out every day for 90 days and then you start to see results. And that's been my experience anyway. What about you?
Yeah, first I want to ask, did the angelic forms you see, were they like, to tie back to the cinema thing, were they like in Dark Song?
Oh, no. So this is the other thing, is that when I see spirits in real life of any kind, then it looks like smoke. It looks like this dark shape, like a gray shadow that's volumetric and in three dimensions. And in this case, it was two of them, and they were at the foot of my bed, and they were taller than the ceiling. So it really messed with my perception of three-dimensional space, which is a little mind-blowing. But I was able to adapt and to listen to them, and they communicated clearly in my mind's eye. And I was able to get all the information that I needed from them. They wanted me to perform a ritual. I worked on the design of rituals so much, and I teach them so much. It was very easy for me to piece together what they wanted me to do. I did it. I got what I was looking for. It all ended up great. I consider it a case of verified gnosis, where a spirit told me to do something I would never have thought to do otherwise. Got a great result from it. But that's how they appear to me. And I found that to be the case, is that a lot of times with spirits, if they appear to you, it's not quite visual. It's more an interference in your visual field that is the shape of a being. And it's very similar to smoke in some ways. But I found that to be the case regardless of the nature of the spirit, which is interesting. So even for angels and, you know, luminous beings, quote unquote, they'll still show up in kind of a low-key way. Has that been your experience?
It's hard to say. When the spirits are most manifest to me, they usually, and again, that's, I say that with an asterisk, it's usually auras without bodies. So I'm not even sure that's calling them manifest, though, in any way. Also, I think it would be wrong to privilege sight over the other senses and experiences. So the idea that because you can see something or think you see something when you look at it, that there's an impression in your mind, because some people say they see the same thing as someone else in the room. Some people say they don't say see something, but someone else doesn't see something. So those seem like two different cases to me, right? Two different things are going on. And I've had both experiences, one where one person can see something, often a scryer, but sometimes just another practitioner in the temple can see something that no one else can see. But I've also had experiences even as early back in my high school Wiccan coven days where we're like, can you see that? It's yes, what do you see? And then we ask the third person, what do you see there? And they describe it, and we're all seeing the same thing. So that's those see me seem to like slightly different things going on. But yeah, I don't think that visual experience should be taken as the greatest sign of manifestation of spirits, especially since just because you see something, or especially catch something out of the corner of your eye, what kind of experience is that? When I have a spirit, a truly what I would call manifest experience with an angelic force or form or being, it's generally arresting and ecstatic, or takes me deep within myself into another place. And that's why I think a lot of the grimoires and reflected in my experience occurs like you do the operation, but then while you're going to sleep, you go into some altered state. This was happening to me like crazy just last night, to the point where I thought I was, is it lucid dreaming or is it being just out of your astral body? So I was, my eyes were fully closed, but I could see the room around me and I could identify things. And I test that a lot because I'm always very self-skeptical of these things. So I like to blindfold myself and have people hold up how many fingers and tell them how they're seeing, just so I know I'm not going crazy. So yeah, we have some questions. Beautiful. Let's jump to some questions before we talk more about cinema, because it was Devil's Night last night and I did watch The Crow. I showed it to my with my mother. She hadn't seen it in years either. So it was a really, it really does. They call it an unfinished masterpiece, but somehow it still became a masterpiece. So they got around the death of Brandon Lee in a really fascinating way when you think about it. Here's a question. This is from Medakis blog. On this point, do you think that magic is happening on a greater scale, but we are unable to perceive it?
Yes.
I think we could perceive it well in our culture today. The warring factions of belief and spiritual ascesis.
Yeah. What is the quote? Reality marks a line in the sand where two warring shamans fought to a standstill. You can see, you can see a lot of that if you develop those abilities, but we're native to the physical plane. And so this is the plane that we see most easily. But other spirits are native to other planes. And so they see those corresponding planes most easily, and they have a harder time seeing the material plane. It's just a matter of perspective. But I feel like all of these things are happening at all times, which is why it's good to have friends. It's really useful to work with spirits to get insight so that they can bring your attention to things that you would otherwise not notice. And so if you have friends, beings of other planes of reality that can perceive these subtle energies a lot better than you can, that's one of the best ways to get around it. And so developing those relationships with spirits is incredibly valuable. But yeah, I believe that these energies are always going on around us. I believe that physical manifestation is the final stage in that process. They're just continuously descending scale of subtle energies, and then it all cashes out as material reality. And this is the point at which we have the least amount of control. And if we can start to influence the subtler levels of the etheric plane, the astral plane, and so on, then we can exert way more influence than we can once everything is fully manifest. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Brent Edwards said something I think is really excellent. He said, I have seen spirits in the form of Predators movie. Cloaking. Yeah, so that's, Brent, you tied in a movie reference beautifully to something that I think is actually the best description I've ever heard of what I see, which is when I see an aura without a body, as I called it in my earliest teenage diaries, that is the effect especially when it moves. But there is, it's so interesting. And it's what's always interesting about these moments is they stay in my memory, whereas a lot of other imaginings or experiences of working with my imagination might be a more ephemeral and come and go. So that it was really excellent. And shout out to Predator, another great film from a bygone age. Medakis blog asks, how would you describe the types of magic manifestations of ceremonial ritualists such as Aleister Crowley? The types of magic manifestations of ceremony, that's one way to say it. that's one choice of words. No diss there.
Yeah,
so, I'll let you take that one.
Perfect.
Because I'm a nice guy.
Of course. Yeah. So it's hard to say the types of manifestation because that assumes that there is an objective thing that everybody will perceive equally, and that's absolutely not the case. I think you made a great point, Fred R.C., with kind of the visual bias that we have when it comes to talking about mystical experience. The fact that visualization is the word we use for imagining something's there. And the fact that it doesn't have to be visual. It can be something that you feel, clairtangience, or it can be something that you hear, clairaudience, or something that you smell, clairolfactants. And so working with these other psychic senses is equally important, including claircognizance. Just knowing a thing is there can be a powerful, powerful way to start visualizing, to start exerting your imagination. And once you start to develop that muscle, you realize that it works both ways. There is talking to the universe by projecting these visualizations, and there's also listening to the universe by perceiving through these visualizations. And again, they can come in the form of visuals, but they can also come in the form of things that you feel, things that you hear or smell or taste or know. And so learning to work with whatever psychic senses are most natural for you. It's very important for learning to get feedback from the rituals that you're doing. And so the types of manifestations that you'll get through ritual is going to be more dependent on your own development and your own tendencies as a ritualist than it will the specific rituals that you are doing.
No, that makes sense. Go through another question. Wait, where was it? I'll give you this one in the meantime. Can you read that? You want to read that?
Oh, yeah, I like that one. So daily practice for the past year or so has consisted of the LRP, MP, microcosmic orbit, devotion to certain saints, Mary and Maishie. What are some lesser known practical exercises I can do daily? Oh, great question. So lesser known practical exercises, prayer. If you get into grimoire magic, it's a lot of praying your ass off. So if you find one or two psalms that you resonate with, saying those in the morning and the evening is a great way to exercise your connection to divinity on a daily basis along certain lines. All of the angels of the Shem HaMefrash have associated psalms. And so that's a great place to start. Start with Vahuya if you'd like to. And
Inflame thyself with prayer.
Yes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there's lots of theories as to why that is effective and used in magic, but the theories are really less important than the practice itself. Here's a thing I want to address. So this is an important question that I think should always be addressed these days so that we don't end up going down the wrong hand path. Medekis again says, most right-hand paths seem to describe higher integrations as a blur, yet right-hand path are very visceral. Well, first, there's no such thing as right-hand path practitioners in the West whatsoever. The whole idea of left-hand path practitioners is a new Western tradition that we've imported from the East. So where I've come to greatly discussing this for dozens of hours as you podcast and really diving into this, talking with everyone, what's her public name? Nora. I forget her public name, but Nora. She's the
LHP
lady. Animo Nora. Yeah. Talking with her, talking with Dr. Puka, who just put out a fabulous course on the left-hand path traditions. So the important thing to understand is just because new people want to come along and adapt LHP idea into their Western practices, that's fine. And Dr. Angela Puka's course on what those traditions are, how they came about and where they're from is really the best place to start with that, in my opinion. So shout out to Dr. Puka's course there. But just because a bunch of people in the modern times come along and start creating this false divide between right-hand path and left-hand path, just because you call yourself LHP or interpret the Western corpus of tradition and magic and alchemy and theurgy into two paths doesn't mean that the rest of us are now right-hand path. So you can call yourself left-hand path and section off only a tiny segment of the Western mystery traditions and call that your thing. But the rest of us are still doing all of it. As John Michael Greer says, we're not doing magic with either hand tied behind your back. So if you want to just focus on the left-hand path because that resonates with you, again, I'm really not disparaging this at all because I understand the importance and value in the variety of spiritualities. But so, yeah, if you want to say, oh, we're not doing this stuff because it's right-hand path, that doesn't mean the people doing it then are right-hand path and don't understand that. It's not how it works. So keep that in mind, and then you'll be able to have better, more fulfilling conversations with other practitioners because you'll realize they're also doing what you're doing as well. They just don't define it the same way. We just don't have this right-left thing in the Western tradition. It's import from the East via Blavatsky and all of these other people and so forth and so on. So by taking, for LHP practitioners, if you stop approaching people you think are right-hand path practitioners as right-hand path practitioners, as these projections you've created of them, you'll have much fuller conversations. And I've been enjoying those fuller conversations with people who understand that just because they have redefined their traditions in certain ways doesn't mean that their definition applies to anyone else. It's just your own thing. And the rest of us are probably still doing the middle path of the Western tradition, which is really what it's about, accessing all things. Let's see what else we have. Zachary Hansen, someone we haven't had yet. Zachary Hansen says, I worked with the Shem angels almost daily, read psalms at morning evening and night and pray without ceasing. Nice. I appreciate that feedback, guys. Glad to know I'm on the right path. Yes, you're on
path.
The correct path. Yeah, just the Shem Angels alone. I've never met a practitioner who'd be like, I work with the Shem Angels, but I make sure I only work with the merciful ones, not the severe ones, because I'm right-hand path. That doesn't exist. That's not a thing.
Oh, no kidding. And how would you categorize Zabra Malin? Like, it's just praying to God for an hour a day, three times a day. It's
so that you can work with demons and subjugate demon kings. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So you can invoke the kings and dukes of hell. And so, like, if you're dividing magic into right and left hand path, your brain is just going to explode when you find out what that ritual is actually about. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's why people are always surprised when I answer why I never really took the Zabra Malin as seriously as other people, by which I mean in practice. I never really pursued it. It's fun to read. It's fun to study. I was the one who made the observation that the English text mistranslated the German manuscript and that it didn't say Passover. In fact, it says to start at Easter. And that was my original observation. So you're welcome very much, everyone who has the English translation, or shall I say mistranslation of the German original. But one of the rare times my German came in useful was to help Aaron Leach and all those other guys out correct what they were misreading. But people are surprised when I say I've never gotten really that into it. I considered it for a while, but I got a pretty stern warning that it really was maybe not for me, especially not then. And that was correct. Of course, it was during lockdown, so that makes sense. It might seem like a good time to do something like that, but maybe not. But the thing the answer I always give is I'm not really that much into Goetia in the sense that it's often understood. I love it in the sense of the Jake Stratton Kent understanding of it, but I've never been a big Goetic magician. Partly that is because in the Golden Dawn, we don't really dive into that till 6 = 5. And even then it's, if you want to,
optional.
There's no requirement for it. So Zabra Malin, they're surprised to hear that about Zabra Malin, and because people don't think of Zabra Malin as Goetia, they don't think of it as in the same breath as they think of the Lesser Key of Solomon, but they should.
Yes.
In a lot of ways. Unless you're claiming that the HGA in the Zabra Malin is somehow the highest of all HGAs and the true self, which I don't think anyone is actually making that claim. So really, it's just another grimoire with another approach that is really interesting and very Lutheran, actually, very Lutheran in its approach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, here's a question from Zach Hansen. Go ahead, reply. Just say whatever you want.
Oh, I was going to say it can be a dangerous ritual just because if you can fail or succeed in magic, and not everybody appreciates that. So if you somehow fail to invoke your holy guardian angel or evoke them or make contact with them, and then you perform the convocation and that works, then you can be in trouble because you have all of these kings and dukes of hell and no real power to bind them with. So it's not the easiest ritual. It's one of the reasons that there's a lot of prohibitions against a lot of restrictions that come with practicing it, and why I highly recommend that people find a teacher like Aaron Leach rather than doing it from a book. But it is a phenomenal ritual if you can complete it. I have an interview on my channel with my friend Bruno, who completed the Zabra Malin successfully and had an absolutely delightful and amazing and life-changing experience. So I think it's a fantastic ritual if you feel called to perform it, but there's plenty of valid reasons for choosing a different path. But I did run over the question. What was the question you had on screen, Frater?
The question on screen is, what has fasting done for us?
Oh, so fasting and a number of
magical spiritual training.
Prohibitions. Things you can't do because you're doing this ritual. It's just to heighten your energy above the material level and towards the spiritual level. That's a double-edged sword, because if you're super dualistic and you think everything material is bad and everything spiritual is good, you're going to blast off and not be able to cope with material existence. And that's not going to be great. And so it's good to have grounding practices and things that reconnect you to Earth after a certain point. But if you're trying to create a major change in consciousness or get a major result, a lot of times fasting and just breaking your relationship or distancing yourself from material existence for a little bit by fasting or having a very restricted diet, I performed the Sword of Moses, in which you only get to drink water and eat bread, plain bread, for 3 days. That's an interesting exercise in asceticism. And I found that to be a very crucial element of the ritual, is having that prohibition on what you can eat and drink in order to attune yourself to the energies of the ritual and really just block out distractions. And so we don't think how much of the historically extravagant food we eat is a distraction from everything else that we're doing. But when you remove that and you can only eat a very small diet, or can't eat anything at all, you don't have that distraction. You have to really concentrate on your rituals and what's happening in your life. And so I find that those kind of prohibitions really just refocus your attention. And then the more focused your attention is on the magic that you're doing, the more powerful it's going to be. Does that make sense?
Yeah. In my experience, it's always been a very interesting one. In my Golden Dawn years, mm-hmm. I was basically light fasting constantly because I had undiagnosed celiac disease, and mm-hmm. Food was just very painful for both me and my sister for many years until we figured mm-hmm. things out. So yeah. It's tough when you have a malabsorption issue. I've always wanted to write a little booklet on malabsorption issues and fasting mm-hmm. and look at the one thing I will say is, like, fasting for, especially if you have absorption issues, which means you don't get enough nutrients from food, mm-hmm. which means it means a lot of things, but it can make fasting rough. So you have to do it carefully, I've found. Mm-hmm. But you can fast off other things. You can fast off social media. You can fast off swearing is mm-hmm. a good thing to not mm-hmm. do during those times. Yeah. And so overall, I recently just did a ritual just the other week with another Golden Dawn adept and some other people. And the other adept couldn't prepare really in the way that would be ideal, but that's fine. It's still mm-hmm. come to the ritual. And but the experience was very hard to connect for them, whereas I had a very profound experience, encountered an angel that was very important for me to get a name from, got a very clear name, like the angel even wrote out the name in Hebrew for me, only without awesome. The vowels. Yeah, it was one of those rituals where, like, oftentimes afterwards with my students and even just fellow magicians, after a ritual, it would be a great ritual, and they'll be like, how was that for you? And I'll be like, meh. And they'll be like, oh my God, you'd be prepared for days or weeks for this, or even months sometimes. And it's mm-hmm. sometimes it's meh. And I'm not going to be one of those charlatans that says my magic always works. And the preparation matters, but the preparation isn't necessarily going to make it or break it. But by far, fasting, it makes communication, in my experience, with spirits much easier. The constant mm-hmm. focus on the divine, on the intention, and on openness to spirit prepares you and gets the attention. I think it makes you glow more brightly on the astral plane, if you like that language. Yes, and it just brings you closer to God, right? There's mm-hmm. the magical, the really old, deeper magical theories that you'll see from Skinner and stuff, where, you know, food creates this, you know, has this more biological processes going on in our body, including the excretion of waste. And mm-hmm. of course, things that what comes out of our skin, it comes out of all that. So you cleanse yourself over 7 days. Right, Jake Stratton Kent would definitely tell you to do 7 days if you were a beginner to grimoire conjuration. He says mm-hmm. that in his night school final book and in his posthumous text. And that's really good advice, especially if you want to have a powerful communication or experience of the presence of the being and have it interact with you more, I think. Yeah, the more you're in your body, the less you're in your spirit, is one classical way of saying it.
Yes. Yes, absolutely true. And I did experience a visual apparition at the end of The Sword of Moses. So that was fun. That was delightful. And it was a great, great confirmation of the experience. I find a lot of those more vivid experiences are just like a big thumbs up from the universe that you did it. And the actual consequences could be great, even if there's no big visual confirmation. But absolutely, fasting and having a restricted diet of some kind is a incredibly useful tool to get out of the body, to get into your spirit, to shine more brightly on the astral plane. I think it's wonderful.
Brent says, fasting's always been extremely important to Jesus. It was important to everyone. It's always been important in religious life. Mm-hmm. I've never seen any period in which it wasn't at least mentioned. Yeah, it's a very important thing. But again, if you're doing magic and practicing and doing a lot of major operations almost every day, you're in a constant state of that. So you want to maintain your health is my point, right? You want to maintain, mm-hmm. make sure you're eating healthy things. I do a lot. I've discovered the joy of green shakes with protein, and that way I'm just drinking something, but I'm also getting some of the basic things my body, because it's, It's hard to, yeah, it's hard to get the nutrients unless you're like eating all these vegetables and maybe some meat or fish or something. It's hard to get that, especially if you don't, if you're only absorbing 20% of what a normal person absorbs, right? And the rest just goes to waste and goes to IBS, and, which is when it it's just soaking through your stomach lining into your body, causing massive inflammation and overwhelming chronic pain. That's what malabsorption diseases do for us. Like, I woke up this morning, chipper and happy, but in massive pain. And that's just because I'm a human being who eats food, and the food does, my body can't handle it. In general, it can't handle eating. Fasting was a big thing for me when I was young, because it was when I felt best. It's, I just eat when I'm in pain from not eating, and just eat enough to not be in pain. So whether that's picking on grapes when you need them, or having a little bit of tea with a bit of honey, that can do the trick. In the Golden Dawn, we had to do, often had to do 24-hour rituals nonstop. That was a very common thing. Many, several times a year, I would have to do that. And it doesn't matter what you're doing, you have to go do that. And with other people often, if ideally. And so, yeah, you're fasting, you're not eating that whole time, and you're ideally not eating before that. But you got to maintain your health as well, because the glory of God is every creature fully alive. And you can't be fully alive if you're grabbing your stomach in bed.
Totally.
I don't think that's fully alive.
No. Yeah. So it's a balance. You got to make sure that you're taking care of this material vehicle so that you can manifest heaven on earth, so that it can bring more of this light into your life, and more of this light into the world. Eating stuff to ground yourself and to other things to connect with your physical existence. Go outside, touch grass, have material experiences, not just spiritual experiences. It's good to balance these things. It also helps to integrate and to help you show up in the world in a better way, in a more powerful way, which a lot of times is the best benefit you can get from ritual. The experiences with spirits are amazing and enlivening and life enhancing, but you really want to see what you can do to be a blessing to yourself and your own material existence, and be a blessing to the world and your daily life. Magic can help you with that as well.
So. Yeah, cool. We got through all the questions. It only took 2 hours. He says, Brent says, I feel angels, but I've never seen one. Yeah, I would stop worrying about seeing things. If you're doing conjuration, there's more than one way to acknowledge the spirit's presence through phenomenon. So a phenomenon often might not be one that's visual. You're looking for some sort of phenomena to confirm that the spirit is going to do what you've asked it to do at the end of the conjuration. In classical grimoire conjuration, and that would be how especially grimoires would look for confirmation that the ritual was going to work and that the spirit's going to do what they want. Of course, in other traditions, that isn't necessarily highlighted so much. Is the crow his higher self, or is it like linked to his spirit body? Because often it seems like he just vanishes and then appears in the crow, right?
See the crow.
Does he get subsumed into the crow? You haven't seen it ever?
No. No.
Oh, what are we even doing here then? Oh my God. Oh my God. Stream over. Close this down. Oh my God. Go watch The Crow. I'll see you here in 2 hours.
Okay,
oh my
cool.
God. Okay. Any other movies you want to talk about?
Oh, TV shows. So as far as The Crow goes, I would think that, that could be interpreted as a relationship with his higher self or his holy guardian angel, depending on what your perspective is. I actually think, The Moon Knight show on Disney is fascinating. Did you get a chance to watch that?
I loved the battle between the Egyptian gods at the end, I have to admit it. And it's such a shame that the show is so underwhelming given the quality of the actors they had in it, right? I always look at shows like you can do whatever you want, because as a creative person, I'm aware of that option for myself. So I know that they also have it when they're doing these things. And then I look at the story they tell, I'm like, so of all the stories about this character you could have told, you thought this was the best one? The best one. And you're wondering why it's crashed and burned. They're just not trying to tell good stories anymore. They're just like choosing the first one or the random one out of the hat. So that's really disappointing. But I really did. I love Khonshu, of course, and I've always
Khonshu.
Loved, but especially since I like to sometimes not work with, I like to work with Thoth as a symbol of Kether, of the Neshama, of the Logos, right? So that's not a lunar form of Thoth, but Thoth comes from the moon. So I like to see Thoth is coming from the moon, rising up to the supernals and descending back to the moon. In the meantime, we have Khonshu there keeping things real and making sure the moon still functions. Thoth is busy being the logos.
Absolutely. We see that in the tarot as well, where the high priestess is associated with the moon and has the moon at her feet, but she has Keter on her crown and she has like the solar cross at her chest, and she's between the pillars of Yakin and Boaz. So it's like the entire tree of life represented by that one card, but that it's through the moon. The moon is the initiatrix into that entire path. And so that eternal aspect of the moon as like the gateway into all magic, even leading up to and to the final unity with the divine, I think is very awesome. And yeah, well, the reason I mentioned Moon Knight is I think that's a wonderful way to wrap your head around the concept of a higher self, because there is this split personality, whereas this lower self that is busy working a crappy job. And then he has this higher self that's off being a superhero and working with this deity that empowers him. And it's this weird process of trying to learn to integrate his higher and lower selves. And that chaos makes up most of the season, which I enjoyed. I enjoy that aspect of the story. And I think it can also be a good kind of warning to the awkward stage of magic where you start to give access to your higher self, but you're not always there. And sometimes you slip into these lower vibration states of ruminating in despair and being weak and worthless. And then you have to remind yourself that you have access to this higher power and to do magic, to invoke your deity or the spirits you're working with to amp yourself back up to that level with the goal of eventually integrating everything, eventually becoming your complete self, where you're at one with your higher self and ideally even at one with your deity. But that process can be a long time, and it takes a lot of theurgy, and it takes a lot of blood, sweat, and tears and rituals to get to that point. And so I think it's a wonderful insight into like how more empowered you can become through the magical process, but also how awkward it can be sometimes. So that's one of the reasons I like that show.
I've always had a strong sense that there's danger in thinking that you can actually get there. I'm a big believer that you can't really get there in this life, that you have to die to really achieve that full state. But also I think it's healthy to have that understanding of, if you don't believe that the journey never ends, then eventually you're going to think that you're king of the castle, top of the hill. And I think that's a very dangerous place to be at, is thinking you've arrived or achieved it, or achieved anything for that matter. But again, that's just my sort of perspective on. And maybe it's more of a methodological approach, whereas like this is best practices, right? Make sure you always think there's somewhere else to go. I've seen many what they thought was their version of success in life, whether professionally or with family or just personally, and then they get depressed and then they stop doing everything and they become very despondent. So it's dangerous to have, this might sound weird to say, but it can be dangerous to have achievable goals. You should have some ones that are unachievable or idealistic, or what we might say as religious. We got another comment. We got another show to talk about here.
Strange Angel. Yeah. That's another show that I need to watch. So after the stream, I will watch The Crow and Strange Angel and then get back to all of you.
Take 3 days off work and just finish some things. Yeah, Strange Angel was great. That was really fun. And it's too bad they messed up so big with having L. Ron Hubbard in the finale and therefore getting canceled. No one's going to convince me it got canceled for any other reason. And I've talked to one of the costumers on the show who's an occultist and was telling me the inside scoop. And apparently it was canceled before that scene perhaps, but I don't know. It seems like very sus.
Yeah. Oh, nice. Thank you, Zach. Absolutely. Awesome. Yeah, that was badass. Yeah, I think that was I really need to watch that show. I think it's excellent. I think it's interesting that they end with L. Ron Hubbard, because a lot of people don't realize that he's connected to ceremonial magic, and that most of the modern mystical and magical tradition comes from the Golden Dawn in one way, shape, or form, whether that's Gardnerian Wicca, which was influenced by the Golden Dawn, or Thelema, obviously from the Golden Dawn, or chaos magic comes from a Golden Dawn adept, or L. Ron Hubbard. Like so much of what people get into these days comes from this original tradition, and it just goes to show how much you can do once you get access to real magic. You can start to rewrite the rules. You can start to create your own tradition if you want to. but it's not always for the best. So it's interesting to, it's worth going to the source of a lot of these things, a lot of the modern magical movement to see where it all came from. And ideally past that to like the Pythagoreanism and Neoplatonism that inspired the Golden Dawn as well.
Yeah, what other movies did you want to talk about?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I always like complaining about the Abramelin. That's always fun.
There's an Abramelin movie?
Yeah, Dark Song.
Oh.
They literally call it...
It's so far from the Abramelin, I even forget that's what it's about. In my head, I'm just like... Ritual, generic ritual, and then it's great.
Yeah,
it's great.
It's so funny because they literally call it the Abramelin in the movie, and like the only thing it has in common with the Abramelin is the Holy Guardian Angel. And like literally everything they do, I think this was intentional though. I think they didn't want anybody watching the movie and then copying things from the movie, so they just made sure that it was like as absurd and not based in reality as possible. But also, they wanted to make it more cinematic, so they just. Videotaping somebody praying three times a day is not going to do the same, not going to get you the same return. But I think it's an interesting choice. I think there's certain aspects of the emotional side of the journey that I think are really insightful, especially the profound emotional revelation on the end. I think that was something they did extremely well in that movie. But understanding that it's a generic ritual movie and that all of the ritual aspects have nothing to do with actual Abramelin, it's important. That's always something I like to talk about.
Yeah, that's a good thing to talk about. Just check. Oh, so we got a little bit. Do you have a little more time to talk? Do you have a hard out here at 4?
Not exactly. Not.
Your hesitation tells me everything I need to know.
Yeah, no, I just want to see, are there any other topics we want to cover?
Yeah, other topics. We already transitioned well into certain magical issues that are interesting. Mm. Any Samhain specific kind of questions? Yes, we've both seen The Holy Mountain by Jodorowsky, I'm sure. Jodorowsky. I actually stopped halfway through because I thought it was gross.
It is an intentionally gross movie, but did you see the ending?
No.
Oh, okay. No. Yeah, the ending was interesting. It wasn't as good as Original Angel. That's another really great TV show. That's, what was it? Very weird. I wouldn't call it, I don't know. There's somewhat, the dances that they do can possibly be called ritual. They certainly do them like rituals. They certainly do them like obsessively to the point of like they're sweating and they're in tears and their bodies are giving out. So yeah, I think Original Angel might qualify under that heading. But they have similar endings, so I'm not going to spoil it, but it's worth seeing. But it's a bizarre movie. It's meant to gross you out and freak you out. And they put as much Kabbalistic symbolism as I can and planetary symbolism. So it's specifically Hermetic Kabbalah. But I don't know that it's certainly not for everybody. It is meant to be offensive.
Yeah, I found it pretty extreme. So I stopped watching it and just put on the unrated version of Caligula instead to lead down the intense to calm down a bit. And here's actually a comment. Here's a great comment from Zachary Hansen. The very first scene of the Lovecraftian movie Color from Outer Space with Nicolas Cage features at the LBRP blew my mind just how randomly came across it the other day. Yeah, I've seen that movie a couple times, actually, because I tricked my mother into seeing it. And she was, of course, traumatized with halfway yes. through it, but had to finish it because she wanted to see how it ended. And my Tommy Chong was in that, so that was cool. He's a local Vancouverer. Right here on he used to be at all my PTA meetings in Waldorf School, and beautiful. It's fun to see him in a Lovecraftian horror movie, and that is a horror movie, don't get us wrong about that. You are sensitive to grotesque horror, do not watch it. And but you can see the LRP done incorrectly at the beginning of that movie. And it is fun that you have her as doing this Wiccan ritual and she's doing the LBRP because that's more appropriate than they realized. I'm sure a lot of people would be like, a Wiccan would never do something like the LBRP. It's like Wicca was basically created by the LBRP. So for more on that, see Magical Beginnings, Wicca Magical Beginnings by David Rankine. Mm-hmm. Wonderful text that traces the origins of each practice in Wicca back to its Golden Dawn and Grimoire roots. Though I think often it favors Grimoire origins over Golden Dawn origins, even when the direct line would be more from the Golden Dawn. But the upside of that is it in it therefore accidentally shows and reveals the grimoire origins of the Golden Dawn. So in an attempt to bypass the Golden Dawn, it accidentally shows that the Golden Dawn is more based on traditional magic than people, detractors would like to people to think. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. The LBRP is just like the most common ritual practice, kind of full stop, among occultists. I think is fantastic. And that's one of the reasons that I love having free community magic gatherings. If you are interested in those, you can go to meetup.com/occult-magic-meetups. And then I host the LBRP over Zoom every month, and everybody can join in. I'll guide you through the process, and then we can all do it together and have an amazing experience. I found group magic is always wonderful, even over Zoom, sensing the increase in energy with other people doing the ritual. And because the LBRP is practiced by Wiccans and everybody else, is a great starting point for dipping your toes into ceremonial magic, doing some spiritual purification and protection, some of this good stuff, and getting to start to experience the world of energies, of spirits.
Did you know that in Ohio, the state Supreme Court could just ignore the reproductive rights amendment we passed last year?
But so many Ohioans voted for it.
That's why we need to keep extremists out of the court by voting for Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that.
Here's the trick. Just remember, don't stop fighting. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes. If you supported Issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue.
I'm so sorry I'm late. I was just talking to my sister about protecting abortion rights.
Wait, didn't we already do that in Ohio? We passed Issue 1 last year.
I know, by a wide margin, too. But now it's up to our state Supreme Court to decide whether they enforce it or ignore it.
Ignore it? Will they really do that?
They will if we don't keep extremists out of the court. But we can protect our rights by electing Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that. Listen, I can barely remember what I had for breakfast this morning.
Here's a trick. All you have to do is remember, don't stop fighting.
Don't stop fighting. Oh, I get it. DSF. Donnelly Stewart Forbes. I love that.
Tell everyone you know, if you supported Issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue, a community of women who care about reproductive rights as much as you do.
And Brad Jagger says, what are your thoughts on astral initiations, as in a temple initiates you from a distance in the astral plane? Brad, I'm not actually familiar with any tradition that does that, so I don't have much knowledge or thoughts on it. It was a scandal back in my Golden Dawn days because people thought that people were doing that, but that wasn't actually happening. There was just...
Really?
You had to go through the initiations physically to go into the grade. Mm-hmm. There was no doubt about that. But I think what happened was because enemies were smearing using the criticism that they were simply only doing astral initiations, the criticism, which was untrue, because you can't astrally initiate someone into the Golden Dawn, maybe not into anything at all. Who knows? I don't know. Mm-hmm. But... Mm-hmm. The untrue critique became what other people then thought was actually going on and started doing that to these days. Mm-hmm. So now there's people actually trying to do that because they believed the criticism, and the criticism was gaslighting. Mm-hmm. It wasn't true. There was no one who could, so astral initiation is definitely not a thing in the Golden Dawn tradition, and just like it isn't, but it might be in some traditions, so I don't want to speak on it. Certainly, there's the belief that all initiations are astral. Mm-hmm. They definitely have to occur on the spiritual level, otherwise they're not really of much use whatsoever, but most of the time also have a physical component. So I can tell you I went through two initiations in the Golden Dawn astrally, but that was just so I could get my grade material and study those lessons in the same way that in the original Golden Dawn, they would have nominal people nominally in the grade. So you'd be a nominal portal member, a nominal adept, so that you could get your grade material and start studying it, because sometimes it can take a long time to get around to your turn for the initiation because there's so much work and so many people are involved. Yeah, but I didn't, and you can look at my diary entries from those astral placeholder initiations. and they're as underwhelming as can be. In one time, I was given the wrong dates. So I wrote my experience thinking I had had an experience, but it wasn't much. And then when I got the correct date, I did it again, and it was about the same. So my diaries would argue that it's not really real. And if you want to say, oh, maybe you're just not sensitive enough, or you weren't in the right state, that was definitely my forte back then, was being, if something was going on, I would sense it generally. And I can't, again, I can tell you my experience, but those were the things I was best at experiencing. So if there was potential for a more profound experience, honestly, I believe I would have had it, because I was, I was at a young age. I never had drunk, never had smoked, never had done anything really sinful at all. And I ate a very rigid, sparse diet, took very good care of myself as best I could, given the diseases I had or didn't know I had. And yeah, the experiences were almost nothing. And as soon as I had the physical initiations shortly thereafter, holy cow, was it profound. Like, it was shocking. And I had experiences in those physical initiations, which I've since read about in accounts by Nick Farrell and other people from different branches of the GDT, who have referred to similar experiences and been like, oh, this was a common thing people would have from the initiation. I'm like, that's what I had happen to me. Holy cow. So I'm not alone in that. So yeah, the initiations are very profound, and you need to go through them properly and physically and as best you can. And anyone trying to tell you that you're initiated into the Golden Dawn through an astral initiation is lying to you.
Yeah. Like,
that the order I was in, Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn International, changed its name to, before that it was Eternal Order of the Golden Dawn. After that it was Hermetic Order of the Morning Star, which was my favorite name. I really fought for us to keep that name, because let's duck out of the whole trademark wars and just be done with it. Like, we have way more cool things to do than worry about what name we're called. But we had the name in Canada, Golden Dawn, so we were stuck with it because we had it legally. Yeah. And so there you go. Those are my, those are my thoughts.
Yeah, I think if you're paying people online for initiations, don't pay them for the initiation. Pay them for the material you're getting or anything else. Treat the initiations as nominal and look at, what are you actually doing? How is it actually changing your life? Is that worth it? I think there can be advantages to learning this material and especially initiating yourself. That's what I've done. That's what I teach other people to do. That is a long process, but you can experience profound transformations by just repeatedly pummeling yourself with the same energy over and over until your life completely changes, and then doing that again at a new level increasingly. And it's not going to be as quick or as instantaneous or as profound as an in-person Golden Dawn initiation in a temple, but you can still get phenomenal results. The catch is, when you self-initiate, nobody cares. You're just, whatever level you've gotten to, that's the level that you've declared for yourself, and that's the level that you've experienced. And that's not something that you can expect other people to acknowledge. But if you're doing magic for acknowledgement, stop. Like, you shouldn't be doing this because it gives you a sense of importance. There are plenty of other things you can be doing for a sense of importance. You should be doing this because it's real and it works and it creates positive changes for you and for the people in your life. And that, to me, should be the focus of your magical practice. A lot of people, for a lot of people, it just becomes another form of chasing status. And that, to me, is by far the most boring side of magic. I think if you're going to be getting into this, you should be focused on the transformations you'll experience, not the labels of those transformations.
So. Yeah, I do want to say something, though, about initiatory experiences. One thing I really love about the grimoire tradition these days is they very much see entering the practice of a grimoire as a kind of initiatory experience, right? When you really do it right, that's what's happening. And I think that makes sense, because that's what is going on in the Abramelin, right? Yeah. That's what's going on in a lot of other texts. And any kind of time you start working with something new, whether it's like Olympic planetary spirits or the Shem angels or whatever, you're initiating a new process, and that's an initiation. So you're initiating that process. So if you're doing ritual work with someone in person or online or just separately, but together and linking up through your divine mind, however you're doing it, those experiences are all, the experiences you have from those things are all real and all valid. And you can have just as powerful an experience working with any other person one-on-one or in a group in any setting as in any other setting. Does that make sense? Like, there's no rules saying that, oh, because there was a hall full of initiates, and the temple's all decked out and everyone's in god forms, that that experience will be more profound for you than, say, some little grimoire practice like the Abramelin, which only takes 6 to 18 months. It's such a short amount of time compared to going through the Golden Dawn system, which takes a much longer to get in touch with the same divine self. Not the same being, of course. Got to be careful to put that caveat on it. God, all of these things are God. Yes. You're getting in touch with God, right?
Yeah, how do you get close
to
God?
So, yeah, don't diminish or disparage in your mind the experience. Like, when I do one-on-one work with people, whether it's here in Vancouver in person or over a Zoom thing, we meditate, like, it can be an incredibly profound experience. I don't even know where to begin. Because you're still doing it, and God's still there. God still exists, and the other person's doing it too. So lots of things are happening, and that's why cyber magic, I think, is kind of working. Like, I always thought it would be funny if it did work at all, but and then when it worked really well, I was like, that does track. But again, for me, it will never replace in-person work. It's just, sadly, we're facing a world that is shying away from physical contact with other human beings. So we got to push back against that. And we got lots of plans. I have lots of plans, and I've already enacted some of them, as you guys know, from the conference last year. And the retreat you went with me on,
yes.
Lots of goals and efforts to have more in-person connections happen in the future.
Yes. I'm excited for it. But yeah, I think cyber magic is a great way for people to start to connect with other people through magic. Asclepius only had Hermes.
Jorge Quiñones, a fellow adept in the Golden Dawn from a sister tradition out of LA from the same period as me, people. Jorge's a good guy. Good guy to ask. And he's doing comedy now, so hopefully he keeps doing that. I want to see more comedy. I'll fly to Salt Lake to see you make Mormon jokes.
Oh, totally. Yeah, take on the god form of George Carlin. Kill the audience. That'd
this be might great. Be a question for you, Marcus. From Medicus blog. Thanks for participating, everyone, today. This is our first little live stream. Call it Theurgy Thursday. It's our first Theurgy Thursday.
Wonderful.
Kicking it off on Samhain, on the eve of Samhain.
So I've recently become a Shaktipat guru, burning karma. Why is it you can't truly progress unless you have been initiated? Can the spirit not do it alone? Yeah, potentially the spirit can do it alone. I think the reason that people think you can't be initiated without the aid of others is because the other people are going to recognize your initiation because they're doing it to you. And so you get social validation and external acknowledgement of your initiation. You can still initiate yourself. You can still have attainments and higher stages of consciousness that you achieve on your own. But nobody's going to necessarily believe you because they weren't there. And so if your main focus is the external validation, stop, don't do it. Stop whatever you're doing and find another reason to do magic. But if your focus is to burn karma, to connect to your deity, to connect to the spirits you're working with, just keep doing that and see what changes happen. I think one of the reasons that I encourage people to manifest, to create practical results from their magic, is that they can start to see the process of how spirit becomes matter. And you should be paying attention to how your ritual practice is informing and influencing the rest of your life. Because the more powerful the practice is, the more it will start to change you and to change the world around you. And that's ultimately the goal. Everything else we're doing is just a tool into that goal. So if you have people who can initiate you in person, that's wonderful. But you can find other ways of getting better at magic and to developing yourself along whatever path and with whatever spirit you want to work with. And the ultimate proof of your practice is not going to be social validation or acknowledgement. The ultimate proof of your practice is the change you experience in yourself and others. Yeah. Thank you, Jorge. Greetings, brothers. Greetings, brother. Oh, Frodo, you're muted.
My bad. If for some reason we should get Jorge on here. If not today, then another Thursday. Drop a link in for him to join us. I would love to do this more and actually put the link out there for people to call in, video call in, and make it that kind of show. That would be a lot of fun. Something you said rung a bell about. Did I forget it though? In the shout out to Jorge, probably. I did lose it. Anyway.
I mentioned.
Oh yeah, just the aspect of initiate. Like you say, why is it you truly can't progress truly unless you've been initiated? What are you talking about? Initiated into what? Like, as soon as you begin, You're initiated. This is what Goethe said. Johann Wolfgang from Goethe, the famous naturalist, magician, and mystic who wrote Faust. And just begin. Just start that spark and the fire begins to grow. And that's initiating into what, though, is the question. What are you beginning? What is your process? You need parameters. In the Golden Dawn, we have parameters set by the officer of the hegemon who stands between the pillars and is ma'at and represents the higher self of the candidate, or the yechida. In the Golden Dawn, we never say holy guardian angel in the Golden Dawn. That's not in the Golden Dawn tradition. We talk about it in terms of the Kabbalistic division of the Neshama, Chia, Yechida, the Ari Kanpin, the greater countenance, all these different sort of categories. It's more complicated than Thelema would have liked people to think. And there's pros and cons to that, to be honest. Mm-hmm. But one of the pros is you have this idea. It's a less defined idea, but it's of this divine self that you want to become enthroned, and that's why we're in preparation for the throne. But the Golden Dawn is also designed to be open to different religious traditions, so there's no specifications within a certain religious tradition as what that experience really has to be or why it's happening, because different religions see these things working in different ways. A Christian member of the Golden Dawn or a Christian adeptus would see it more as preparing themselves for God's action, whereas a Jewish person would see it more as them exciting God's response through their actions, because that's more part of the Jewish view on things. I don't know exactly how a Muslim adept might see it in the Golden Dawn, despite having been initiated by a Muslim adept, the great Nineveh Shadrach, but you can all go right to him and see. I'm sure he would love to talk about his Golden Dawn experience in the early 90s with you guys. Don't pause. Don't ask about that. But I don't know how he interpreted that in his religious milieu. But the hegemon carries the mitre-headed scepter, which, as they say in the Neophyte initiation, represents religion, which guides and regulates life. So it's very important in the Golden Dawn that you have this sense of a religious structure to frame all of these things. If you don't, that's probably fine. Like, a lot of people have just a generic pagan structure. I certainly did. I didn't become Christian until after I had completed the Golden Dawn system. That was just part of my own journey. I guess I'd run out of DJ Conway books on Druid magic to read, and I turned to the Bible. That's not true, but it is. Really, always it was Hermeticism and the Hermetica for me, and Asclepius. Like, I was constantly carrying my divine pyamander from the Yogi Publication Society around me. That's my whole growing up. And it was obviously badly translated, like, lines like providence is the minister of necessity. I'm like, none of these words sound like they would have been said 2000 years ago. They don't really seem like the verbiage that accurately represents the vibe behind this teaching, but it's what we had at the time. So now we have much better stuff, like the new Hermetica 1 text by David Litwa for $20 on Amazon. That is the new Bible of Hermeticists. That is the new, the first and main text, the Hermetic. A practitioner should want to buy is Hermetica 1, which he self-published so that it wouldn't have the exorbitant Oxford or Brill cost of, like, his academic books do. So shout out to Dr. Litwa's wonderful work that's going on. Yeah, there was another question I wanted to get to. Yeah, so anyway, there's my little rant on what are the parameters? There's not just initiated. It's not an ontological generic state that governs all things everywhere equally. It's, what are you talking about? What is the practice? And again, keep in mind that, again, some of the most popular initiations are the most well-regarded. If you want to talk about status, a lot of people have, because I teach a course on Golden Dawn self-initiation to help people with that process now, and that's taking up all my time, and it's really wonderful and really amazing to see how that works for people. It's just been very illuminating, and the thing that blows me away is to see it working, right? To see self-initiation working. And a lot of people are concerned, like, will I be recognized as a self-initiate by other people? That's automatically the wrong frame of mind. If you have that frame of mind is going to be your greeting card to people, right? It doesn't matter who you are or what you say. The fact that you think that way will be noticeable by people who can notice it, and that's all that they'll see, because it's the wrong mentality to have. That is not an adeptus mentality, and you want to abandon yourself of that, rid yourself of it, and start to actually just take the work seriously for what it is and what it's going to mean for you. And once you start doing that, other people might start noticing you as whatever stage you're actually at. But if you're worried about how others perceive you or how others recognize you, then you're at a stage of the journey that hasn't even rid itself of that basic dross yet. You're going to need a lot of fire to burn that out of you, possibly. And that's not a bad thing. That's a very good thing. But keep in mind, the most reputable initiations are self-initiations. The Abramelin, yes, for sure, mm-hmm, is the most reputable initiation. Mm-hmm. So would you rather tell people that you got initiated by others in the Golden Dawn or that you did the Abramelin? Probably the Abramelin, if you care about some sort of validation that externally. Is, yeah. Until in the meantime, till you get internal validation from God, you might, yes, need it as a crutch to get you through things. And that's okay. It's why we have martial arts belts and stuff like that. And eventually you get tired of all the martial arts belts, so you abandon them and actually do a real martial art like Bujinkan. Yeah. The last point of that is the Enochian self-initiations from John Z. Those are all self-initiations. Yeah. They can only be done by you alone. And so those are both, in my opinion, far more reputable practices than building your self-esteem on a astral initiation from a modern GD group, right? If they're not giving you physical initiations, then they're half-assing it and they should get their acts together. Just my opinion.
Oh, it's true. A lot of places are doing it right, where they will teach you online, but they will require you to fly down and initiate in person, which is, if you're doing anything online, that's the best way to do it. But yeah, this is my opinion. But what I see from a lot of spiritual paths is that at a certain point, the path turns inside out, where you spend the first half of it trying to work on yourself, and then you realize that what actually happens to you doesn't matter, and that your impact on the world is the only thing that's actually important in the eyes of God or in the eyes of history. And so you start to work more on building up your physical life, enhancing the lives of other people around you. And that's easier to spot. And so if other people are evaluating you on your spiritual bona fides, they're not going to care about what rituals you've done. They're going to care about how you're living your life and the effect that you have on the people around you. And that is going to mean a lot more than whatever rituals you've accomplished. Ooh, a demonic possession or oppression attacks from messing with the occult. Yes, many such cases. I love the Evil Dead franchise for when Bruce Campbell says Nectu Rata Necktie and messes up the incantation, and that happens. And if you happen to be working with demons or any other adversarial spirits and you do not do the instructions correctly, or sometimes even if you do, but you are dumb and the spirit knows they can mess with you, or you have weak willpower and the stuff you're doing is not effective, you can get severely messed up. Because then you're inviting this thing to your life, and while you thought you would be able to bind and control it, instead, the reverse has happened. And so demons are not always nice and friendly. Some of them are malevolent and evil, and basically they're predators, and they want to eat your energy. I know a lot of people think that demons are friendly and kind and everything these days, but I'm not buying it. I'm not going for it. I think angels are safer to work with. If you can work with angels, maybe you can handle yourself around demons. Some people can handle themselves around demons. There are a lot of people who can't and are just messing themselves up. So yeah, you can totally mess yourself up, especially if you're invoking with spicier spirits.
You can mess yourself up with any spirit, angels included. Again, like the idea of the angels being fluffy, mm-hmm, and nice and demons being nasty and dark is just wrong completely. So it's historically the case, right? Because a lot of the demons listed as demons are angels. So therefore, it's just, that's the way it is. Like the catalogs of demons are filled with angels, and a lot of angels are seen as demons by other people. So clearly the experiences, there's no dividing line between those experiences. There's not these dark demons below and these angels above, and they have these two distinct natures. The history of magic testifies against that, not to mention modern day practitioners' experiences. Right, like Samael is listed as a demon, but it's an angel of Mars. It's an archangel of Mars. So which is it, right? That would be my only thing about that. And also a lot of chthonic spirits, they seem like demons, but they're more like fairies. And
so this is where I disagree. Is there a difference between chthonic spirits and celestial spirits? Because that to me is the difference between demons and angels.
Yeah, I think that's the fairest categorization if you're using those dualistic frames I just don't think the dualistic framework makes any sense when you compare it to the experience of modern practitioners, and it certainly doesn't hold up in any historical context, except for, unless you are taking very small and brief subsections of the tradition, like the Ars Goetia, and saying, no, these demons are demons, and anything listed in as demons here are not angels. But you can't say that, because it would contradict everything else. So it just doesn't really hold up in the historical record. And again, modern practitioners overwhelmingly have the experience of some angels seeming more like demons and some demons seeming more like angels. I think a lot of it might have to do with the person or the way they communicate. And then there's the well-known problem of having demons, spirits of the air, which are not chthonic, right? Most demons are generally seen as spirits of the air. And Jake Stratton Kent, I think it was, who really describes how demons went from being underworld spirits into spirits of the air historically as time went on, which tells you right there, just that fact that progression can happen denies the dualistic frame of interpretation, because otherwise they would stay where they're at and they wouldn't move to this other category. But they can move to these other categories because they're transcategorical spirits is the only explanation. Otherwise,
The alternative explanation is that the name, the same name is not always the same spirit. And so this is a disagreement I get into, which is there can be multiple people named Michael. They're not all the same person. There can be multiple spirits named anything in the book. They're not necessarily the same spirit. And so if you're talking about a demon of the air and a demon that's chthonic, I'd argue they're different spirits, even if you're using the same name. The energy that you're drawing upon defines the character of the spirit. This is something that Nick Farrell talks about in Helios Unbound, that there are these rays, these fundamental forces, and then what we experience as spirits is actually the masks that these forces put on to interact with humanity. And so they are not substantial people in the way that we can consider ourselves and each other substantial people. They are representations of these cosmic and chthonic forces of consciousness that are assuming forms in order to interact with us or accomplish tasks, but they're not necessarily people in the way that we consider ourselves to be people. And so to me, the forces on which spirit is drawing are primary, and then their identity is absolutely secondary. It's literally just a mask.
Yeah, one thing you all have to look forward to is Marcus and I, who have been talking every Thursday for well over a year now, we don't actually have all the same opinions on things. So the last thing you're going to get here is an echo chamber. And we debate the metaphysics of these things often, especially in contrast to our experience and the experience of others. So that's always fun. And often if we don't respond to the other's differing point of view, it's not because we're agreeing or disagreeing with it. It's just we don't mind there being different points of view, and it's fun to hold those views in tension with each other, because sometimes you might have an experience that makes you go, oh my god, I don't even know how to understand this, and then you're like, oh, it would make sense from this perspective, damn it, I have to change my interpretation of things here. But I think you're wrong on that one, but that's fine.
That's okay. No, that's all right. That's all right. No, I think it's fine to agree to disagree. And yeah, if you're debating, either you'll be proven right or you'll learn something, or you'll disagree to disagree.
And I don't actually think you're wrong. I just think understanding exists differently on different levels. So for a great example of that, of course, is psychedelics, where your understanding of reality changes. And you're like, oh, I don't think about reality in the same way in this state of being. So I think after death, in spirit realms, we won't see things the way we see them. And so I'm always hesitant of interpretations that are the byproduct of incarnation. So this embodied form of nature that we inhabit right now gives us certain predicates and pre-understandings of things. And understandings and interpretations that come out of that, I think, are very weak and tend to not hold up when you go into those spirit realms. So in some ways, a lot of the times, I think it's important to say, does it matter? Does the debate, do two different debates even matter necessarily between two points of view? Because they're just the results of this world of form in which these dichotomies or paradoxes seem very real. But then once we die and go into the spirit world, we're like, oh, it all makes sense now, but I can think fractally. And that's something I couldn't do in my body. So what the hell? And let's also not forget the point of when your people often are communicating with celestial spirits, they're often getting interference from spirits of the air or demons, if you like, mm-hmm. pretending to be those spirits. So one thing important to watch out as a magician is, are you talking to the spirit you think you're talking
yes.
to? That's whether you're doing mm-hmm. full-on conjuration or mm-hmm. astral work or whatever, that's a real problem. That is something, mm-hmm. like, it doesn't matter how profound my experience with a spirit is mm-hmm. or an intelligence. In the moment, I deal with it on the ground, in person, as it comes to me. But then I write it down in my diary. But afterwards, I'm very skeptical. The more profound and more real an experience is, generally the more skeptical I am of it later on. And I don't know if that's necessarily a good thing, but it's worked for me so far because it allows me to, I think, keep common sense in play a little bit more than some people like. But that's when you're looking for the really real experience. And I'm talking about like demonstrable results and effects and abilities. I think it's under good advice to be harsh with yourself about what this thing really was. And again, that's just my point of view. Answer Zachary's question at last. Have you experienced, mm-hmm. personally known someone who had demonic possession or oppression attacks from messing with the occult? Messing with the occult's a weird phrase to say it, period. I don't think anyone messing with the occult is going to be in danger of having any kind of problems whatsoever, because you have to be put in years of work to get any results usually whatsoever, let alone is someone picking up some random incantation going to get a result. They might luck out. Beginner's luck is a thing. And the spirits, sometimes certain spirits do take interest. A lot of spirits actually do. Mm-hmm. Little larvae, as they call themselves, are very interested in people messing around at an unprotected low level and often obsess their minds. And then you see people, they read something about the occult, they get some idea of it in their head, they become obsessed with it, become a right-wing Christian, and next thing you know, they've overdosed. And you're like, wow, that he was a really nice guy before he, like, went insane, right? I've seen that happen so many times. That's the craziest thing,
yeah,
is when people dabble around, and then they just become obsessed with some obsessive idea, and the next thing you know, they're burning down Masonic lodges, chanting, "Free the children," outside. All kinds of craziness. But as for actual demonic possession, or possession, I think it's better just to call it, because mm-hmm. demons, angels, whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't know if what it's the difference. I'm going to let God keep that knowledge for himself. But I've seen and experienced real possession, real exorcism. And my experience is that usually you don't notice it, because usually in most cases, I think the person will just kill themselves right away, run into traffic. And that's what most spirits will have a person do when they're possessed, just kill themselves right away. So I think sometimes when you hear of shocking deaths like that out of the blue with someone who is a well-known practitioner or dabbling, mm-hmm. that might be what's happened. But I think it's way rarer than anyone imagines. And I think 99.9% of people who claim they've experienced these things haven't. I'm very skeptical of my own observations in this regard, but I did have very direct experience of this back in 98. And mm-hmm. was really unfortunate and very sad, and it's not something you should mess around with or pursue by any means. It's a horrible mistake to make.
Yeah, so don't do it badly. Do it by the book, do it with care and respect, and find a qualified teacher if you can. So
like my mentor always said, look up before you look down.
Yes, I think that is a wonderful way to begin.
Of course, we were standing in the vault at the time, so it had good context, and it had specific context. It wasn't a general rule. Don't work with fairy spirits because they're chthonic and therefore demonic, and therefore fairy Wiccans are demonists. No, it's not saying that. I think fairy Wiccans are very safe, leaving milk and sugar out in the flower bed for pukas to bring them good luck, or clericons, or naiads or dryads or whatever you're working with.
Yeah. My experience with fairies is that fairy spirits is that they're just very particular on who they like and who they don't. And if not one of the people that they like, I just stay away. So, yeah.
One thing I can say is they do the offerings. I've made the mistake of working fairy kings, and they're like very elemental forces of nature. They're there's like a very powerful intelligence behind them and a very strong presence to them, especially when they physically appear. And offerings are good. I would say maybe make way more offerings than you think you should for a longer period than you think you should. And actually treat them more like kings than you might imagine, rather than just as spirits who happen to be kings mythologically. That would be my advice on working with those spirits. And I do a lot of work with those spirits regularly. Just did that for Halloween ceremony. And yeah, and their erratic forces is what I find is, that's what the most demonic thing about them is, how erratic they are, because I think they're very much integrated into primal nature rather than being super celestial or anything like that.
Yeah, they're not from around here, so don't expect them to be to act like humans.
Yeah. Cool.
All right. We have been
Oh my God, did we just almost 40 minutes just pass since last I looked it was like 4 o'clock and now it's that time.
Oh yeah.
Flies.
We got into an argument.
Not really.
A disagreement. I have a philosophy degree, so argument is not a bad thing to me. Argument is like a cool way to explain your position.
Yeah.
And it's fun and we do it with friends. So it's a different perspective. But yeah.
It's an interesting idea. The idea that everyone has their own version of their own spirit or like the Mikhail that I communicate with is different than the Mikhail that you communicate with. So you believe that there are two different Mikhails perhaps. But that doesn't make any sense to me. What makes sense is you're communicating with a microcosmic reflection of the spirit. Mm-hmm. For yourself, but it's the same spirit. Mm-hmm. It's the same spirit. There's no two versions of that spirit. There's just that spirit is its own reality. And we experience it in a fragmented way because we have our own spheres and our own consciousness that it impresses upon, right? So because it impresses differently and is interpreted differently by two different people doesn't mean that there's two of it would be my argument. And again, I'm not saying you're wrong. Yeah. I just disagree with you. So we can let that be. People should be exposed to the different forms of interpretation of these things so that they have some understanding of what is common, what's a common experience, and where there's maybe of how people can have the same experience but just understand it differently, but it doesn't really make that much of a difference, and so there's no need getting our panties in a bunch over it.
Yeah, to me, like Gabriel of water and Gabriel of the moon are two different people named Gabe.
Really? Those are different angels for you? Oh, yes. My God. Oh, my God. Yeah, we come from very different traditions in that regard.
They're related, but they're fundamentally different. And so to me, it's a matter of what map you're using that best explains your experience, and just find one that works for you and stick to it. I really just want everyone to find what they need to help them shine. That can be different traditions, different philosophies, different metaphysics. Whatever it is, if it works for you, fantastic. If it doesn't work for you, change it. That's the best advice I can possibly give. So,
absolutely. And you should experiment. Like Chaos Magic, I think, is right on point when it talks about experimenting with different names and paradigm switching. That really isn't a Chaos Magic thing. That's just a human thing. And it's good advice. You should think about things from different perspectives and see if you can find explanations that make more sense given your experience. And here's an interesting one from Zachary Hansen. Mainly by occult, I was referring to Guedia and ceremonial magic. Well, Guedia is ceremonial magic in its grimoire form, unless you go the JSK route. The recent exorcist on the Sean Ryan podcast brought up some caution and discernment to mind, heart. Mm-hmm. Yes, I don't. That's very vague. Brought up some caution and discernment to mind, heart. I don't know really what you mean by that, so I'm not sure how to respond, but I can tell you if it's one of the Catholic exorcists, they literally are not able to interpret things based on their experience. They have to interpret things based on Roman Catholic dogma. They have no choice on that. So if it's a Roman Catholic priest exorcist, you got to understand their understanding to see in it anything that might be interpreted as real. You have to filter out their dogma because they have language and ways of seeing it that they're required to use. And that doesn't mean that they're not dealing with an actual possession. I just, most of the time, obviously, they have a lot of tests in place to make sure, like the person has to go to therapy for a year first, right? When someone comes to you and they're like, oh, I'm possessed. No, they're not. No, they're not. They're not possessed. 99% of the time, they might be possessed by some obsessing thought or like you can interpret like mental illness as spirit possession. You can do that. It was the ancient way to see mental illness. So that's okay, I suppose, if you look at it from that perspective. Even magic can be helpful with dealing with mental illness.
Yeah, and it's important to distinguish possession from obsession. Like, in cases of actual possession, spirits tend to be bad at having human bodies. And so speaking incoherently, not being able to function as a human, possibly getting themselves killed, as you were talking about, those are all things that could happen during a possession. What's far more common is obsession, which is just negative spiritual influence, which everybody knows about somebody in their lives that had negative influence from another human being and then became a worse person. The same is true of spirits. They can make you a worse person if they're a bad spirit and they push you in a bad direction. And so that discernment of who are you working with and what kind of person are they making you into is very important. The test I give people for spirits comes from Jesus: by their fruits ye shall know them. If working with a spirit makes your life better, keep doing it. If working with the spirit makes your life worse, stop. Banish that spirit. Get rid of them. Fire them. Get a new spirit. I think that's probably the best advice I can give for working with any tradition.
I'm just imagining a cartoon where it's like the holy guardian angels. It's, hey, I need to see you in my office. And the HGA goes in. He's, we're going to have to let you go. This isn't working out. I know we had a good run with the Abramelin tradition, but it's time to go Enochian. And it's the Lutheranism, we got to go Anglican. We got to go high church Anglican now. So we're going Enochian. If that doesn't work out, fairy Wicca. HGA gets fired. That would be a fun cartoon for what's her name to do? The cartoonist, Molly Wally. Mm. Molly Wally should do totally. A holy guardian angel getting fired scene. That'd be hilarious. You don't serve me anymore. Maybe you should serve me. Maybe you should serve God and stop worrying about what I'm going to do for you. What are you going to do for God?
I don't know. I think that can be a trap. If you're only being asked to sacrifice and if you're not getting what you need to sustain yourself in return, that's a scam. And that can be true if it's coming from a human as well. So pay attention. You should be nourished and empowered in the ways that allow you to serve. Yeah, it's a two-way street.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got through, we have no more questions right now. We just got one.
Yeah. I'd like to wrap up. We've been going for 90 minutes now.
Yeah, I thought we were, okay, amazing. We'll do, this is the last question we'll do. Right, that's cool. Zachary's response. We should let him respond. This was exactly my intuition was telling me about his testimony as a Catholic exorcist. I really appreciate it. You're welcome. Everyone's very welcome. And thank you everyone for being here. Wow. We got quite a lot of people watching us right now, which is
wonderful.
This is the most we've had all stream. I can see why the kids do it for 12 hours all day. And wonder why their lives fall apart even though they're rich. So yeah, I think the Catholic and clergy exorcists often do a fine job helping people, especially who think they're possessed but aren't, and in the rare cases of possession. The thing that upsets me about these people, and we'll end with a little exorcist commentary, we'll end on a high note for the movies. The Exorcist, classic Halloween movie, classic spooky movie. The thing about all of the phenomena in that movie is you hear about it in real life from these exorcists, but the Catholic Church doesn't allow these things to be filmed, which in my opinion is the biggest cop-out of all time. Whenever I think I can do something or think I can show it to someone, I generally do to everyone and anyone I can and who I meet, especially when magicians and adepts get together. Generally, we show each other what we're made of, what we can do. And that goes for filming as well. If people are saying that they're seeing things that they could be filmed, have them film it. If people tell me that I've had a lot of friends in my life who say that things fly around their house all the time and they refuse to film it. Without exception, they've always, on principle, refused to film it. And it's just, okay, that's cool. Whatever. I'm not going to worry about it at all. But I'm also not going to believe you. I'm not going to believe you for a second. Not for a second. Because if I ever saw anything move around my house, there'd be trail cams up the wazoo around this place to catch anything. Because sure, no, you can't put it online and have anyone believe you it's real. Obviously, they'll always think it's fake. That's why you can't demonstrate stuff online. You can't demonstrate telekinesis with dowsing rods online because no one will believe it. You can't do any of that stuff online. No one will believe it, especially with AI. But in real life, you can. And it's very surprising when you see people demonstrate things because they're also experiencing how you're doing it. You're often telling them how you're doing it, what you're experiencing. And then it's replicable. If it's not replicable, then something else is, who knows? That's very interesting in and of itself, right? So that's my thoughts on the Roman Catholics refusing to, people are always floating around the room. They're always, all they have to do is film it once and they instantly would get double the size of their converts. They'd get another billion members converting to, just like if anyone actually went out into the street and levitated all, and they were like, yes, you could do this too. Just become vegan and worship Hare Krishna. Guess what would happen? You'd get, do you know how many people do you think would become vegans worshiping Hare Krishna if the Hare Krishna started floating around the streets and being like, this is all it took?
Okay, my counter to that is, what was it? Jesus went around performing literal miracles. He got a lot of people very fast, and then he was betrayed by his friends and tortured to death by the state. So I don't think it's always necessarily safe to break the laws of physics. And that may be one of the reasons people want to keep a lid on this stuff. But
I'd like that to be the reason. I'm not sure if I buy it, but we do have a lot of testimonies of what was the Anton Yelkin, that poor actor who died with Dennis, with Anthony Hopkins. Anton and Anthony, the great Stephen King adaptation they did together. But Anthony Hopkins plays a psychic and the government's after him and he's hiding and then he helps the kid, but that gets him caught. I forget the name of that movie, but that's a really great understated movie. That's the thing I like about Stephen King's psychism, the way he displays it, is in a very, I think he's had some experience with some people who could actually do a few things, honestly, or had some experiences himself. Or maybe he just did a lot of cocaine. Who knows? With him, it's anything's possible. And he's a wild guy. So who knows where he got those ideas from. But this has been a lot of fun. Thanks for joining us this Halloween to kick off Theurgy Thursdays. I like that.
Yeah, happy Samhain all. Thank you. Mm-hmm. See you later.
And if you see something floating around in the air, remember, you have a camera on your phone. And if it's happening all the time, just put cameras everywhere, and then you'll change the world. You'll change the world.
All right.
Happy Halloween, everybody. Tonight is Halloween. Tomorrow's Hallow Day. Iasawin. Gamani Gias and Shah Nahwil Slan. Bye bye. Love you, Marcus.
Right. Love you, Father.
I'm so sorry I'm late. I was just talking to my sister about protecting abortion rights.
Wait, didn't we already do that in Ohio? We passed issue 1 last year.
I know, by a wide margin, too. But now it's up to our state Supreme Court to decide whether they enforce it or ignore it.
Ignore it? Will they really do that?
They will if we don't keep extremists out of the court, but we can protect our rights by electing Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that. Listen, I can barely remember what I had for breakfast this morning.
Here's a trick. All you have to do is remember, don't stop fighting.
Don't stop fighting. Oh, I get it. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, Forbes. I love that.
Tell everyone you know, if you supported issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue, a community of women who care about reproductive rights as much as you do.
Did you know that in Ohio, the state Supreme Court could just ignore the Reproductive Rights Amendment we passed last year?
But so many Ohioans voted for it.
That's why we need to keep extremists out of the court by voting for Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that.
Here's the trick. Just remember, don't stop fighting. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes. If you supported issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue.